Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. This is Philip Lance, your host for today's podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Lynn Kutnauer and Dr. Richard Tusch about their book, Conundrums and Predicaments in Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis, published in 2018 by Routledge. Dr. Tusch is a training and supervising analyst at the New Center for Psychoanalysis and the Psychoanalytic Center of California, two institutes here in Los Angeles. He has received several prestigious awards for his writing and teaching. Dr. Kutnauer is also a training and supervising analyst at the New Center for Psychoanalysis in Los Angeles, and she is the founder of the Clinical Moments program here in Los Angeles. I think this book will be particularly interesting to people who are interested in comparative psychoanalysis, either learning it or teaching it. I also think it will be appreciated by clinicians who want a book that you can keep by your bedside and maybe read a chapter a week as a kind of a tune-up or an inspiration for the daily work of seeing patients. So welcome to the program, Drs. Kutnauer and Tusch.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
And so let's jump right into telling us about what you're trying to accomplish with this book. So before you get into the Clinical Moments program, maybe just tell what's the sort of objective that you want to happen with this book?
Well, the this book grew out of the Clinical Moments program, which Lynn will be talking a little more about. But what we wanted to do is present a easy, accessible experience where we pick a dozen clinical vignettes in which the therapist felt a little thrown. This is a conundrum. I don't know quite how to proceed, and then throw it out to experts as to what they think about the situation and what they might do had they been in the therapist's shoes. So what we're trying to do is present to challenge the reader and to challenge the commentators with unusual clinical moments where it's not business as usual, where you have to kind of think on your feet. You may not be able to fall back on traditional rules you learned in training, and you have to come up with something a little different because you don't know quite how to handle the situation. It seems fraught with difficulty. Maybe potentially therapy threatening, you know. So we wanted to get people to think about these situations and to see if these clinical moments might help them get at their core beliefs about how therapy works and how therapy can help people change. So that's the idea.
And I guess a little follow up then to that. So it's not just to help people figure out what to do in difficult situations in a therapy. As I said in my introduction, I think it's a good book to sort of learn about comparative psychoanalysis, which what do you guys think about that idea that this book helps with people interested in that, comparing different schools?
Yeah. Lynn, do you want to?
Sure. Yeah, I agree. One of the things that has been important in clinical moments in terms of the program that we run, as well as the book, is that it's a way of getting clinicians to think about thinking psychoanalytically, really engaging the idea of multiple perspectives and how do we think analytically? How do we listen? What guides us? And both the Clinical Moments program as well as the project, the book, I think are really useful in that way.
Why don't you tell us more about what is the Clinical Moments program, Lynn?
Sure. Well, the Clinical Moments program actually began in about 2004, 2005 at the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute, which is where I had trained, Dr. Marvin Margolis. was very, very interested in changing the public public professional view about psychoanalysis. He really wanted to make it be less elitist, less exclusionary, and wanted to open it up to people who weren't currently involved in the analytic institute. He wanted to modify the look of analysis. And what he decided is that one of the best ways is to really make it informal and welcoming. And so the Clinical Moments program started as a monthly meeting in various analyst homes. And he thought that would help make it warm and welcoming. And it involved dinner. He thought the best way to make people feel welcome and comfortable was to feed them. And so the program began its one evening a month, the same evening. And he would invite graduate students in psychology, psychiatric residents, people newly graduated in the field, as well as people in the field who had been practicing for a while, and to come for an evening and to eat, develop a sense of community, and listen to clinical material. And as Rich was talking about earlier, each month a different analyst would present process material from an ongoing case, typically, in which there was a moment in the session where the therapist felt taken off guard at indeed a choice point of how do I proceed? And the other thing that came of it is that a lot of times people beginning their career had the sense that even experienced senior analysts struggled in a particular moment, at a particular time in a case. And I think it really helped people new in the field and students realize that they weren't the only ones who were in question at a time.
Do you know, are there many other institutes around the country that, so it's Michigan and Los Angeles, do you think there's others?
You know, I am not sure. Rich, do you have information on that?
Yeah, I was under the impression, I don't know how I heard of this, but I thought there was something at Yale that they did that was similar. That's the only other place where that might be going on.
And I think this book may inspire other institutes as it sort of to do something similar, because it seems like a really effective way of beginning to draw in clinicians who may be interested in psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic psychotherapy, or possibly interested in entering into training but aren't ready for that yet. But why don't you maybe, Richard, tell us about how the book is more organized, sort of chapter by chapter, and maybe as a part of that too, there's a section about the flawed experimental design, and which I thought was interesting. So, how does it work?
Okay, well, Lynn was instrumental in helping pick the 12 moments. Seven of them come from analysts in Los Angeles, five from analysts in Michigan. So she was cherry picking the very best clinical moments, at least from a teaching standpoint. And then once we had those 12 moments, I somewhat arbitrarily organized them into categories, which may or may not be a little forced. You know, two of them seem directly to have to do with countertransference enactments. Three of them have to do with a discrepancy between what patients want and what therapists believe they're capable of providing. Four of them have to do with the issue of having impact, both the impact of the therapist on the patient and the patient on the therapist, and how power is balanced. So that's kind of how we organized it. We had 12 moments, and then we decided to break them up into four lots and organize them in that way. The flawed experimental design is an interesting concept. You know, initially when we sent out instructions to commentators, I had emphasized more the issue of how might you have responded had you been in the therapist's shoes. And Lynn was very wise in re-emphasizing, what does this situation that's being presented make you think? That we reversed the order and made it more important to look at how commentators think about the situation rather than how they think they might respond. It's how do you think you might respond that's the flawed experimental design. Back in the 80s, I was in supervision with Sid Fine, and he and his wife did this experiment where they took some clinical material and they presented it to different groups of analysts organized around what their theoretical orientation is, Kleinians, ego psychologists, and I think at that time it was self-psychologists. They said, here's clinical material. Tell us how you would respond. At what point in the material would you break in? What would you say? And they came up with some conclusions. And I said to Sid, you know, there's something flawed about this because, you know, even though it looks like you're giving them a lot to work with, these commentators really aren't there. They don't have a history. They're not in the room. They don't have a visceral sense. They really don't have a countertransference to work from. And so it's a little bit flawed because you think you're doing an assay of how these commentators would actually work in the moment with this presented patient. That's probably not true, because what they're probably doing is falling back on default ways of thinking and interacting, when if they actually had been in the therapist's shoes all along, then they would probably be responding differently. So in the commentators lack a firsthand visceral sense of what it's like to be in the room with the patient and a history with the patient, it's very hard to reasonably expect them to be able to comment on what would you do. So much better to get them to comment on what do you think about the situation. And in Lynn's emphasizing that part, I think that was very much correct, because that if there's something we feel we can scientifically get to, it's more what does this make you think, not how do you think you'd act. So that's what the flawed design is. It's about thinking that the commentators have authority to be able to reasonably say, well, you know, I wouldn't have done it that way. You know, that's not the right way to do it. I would have done it this way. That's where you get into trouble in supervision and in commenting on clinical moments.
Yeah, I noticed so many of the commentators in their responses were so careful to say, I wasn't there. But here's how I might conceptualize what might be going on. So there were lots of different commentators, and maybe Lynn, maybe you could, like, who were these commentators? Maybe, I don't know, mention some names or to the schools they're from.
Yes. You know, Richard was really helpful in making sure that we had commentators really from all different schools of thought. That one of the things that I think is so important in this is that we have so many different ways of thinking represented. So that in terms of the list of commentators, there's Salman Akhtar and Ann Alvarez, Rosemary Balsam. I mean, it goes through. We have people that are really think about things in an intrapsychic way that really defining the conflict and interpreting the conflict. We have commentators that are much more from an interpersonal school. Rich knows a lot of the commentators personally, and that was really helpful in that part of the book because he has had relationships with them.
Let me go over some of them in categories. For instance, you know, I felt it was very important to make the book eclectic, to make it rich. So in terms of Kleinians, there's Ann Alvarez and Rachel Bloss, Albert Mason, and Irma Brennman-Pick. And there are a bunch of ego psychologists, Alan Sugarman and Bob Michaels and Judy Kantrowitz and Fred Bush, those kinds of people. Mitchell Wilson is kind of a Lacanian. And then a bunch of relational people, you know, Donald Stern, Joe Lichtenberg, Edgar Levinson, who I was particularly pleased at getting to participate, Jay Greenberg, Darlene Bregman, Darlene Ehrenberg, James Fossage. So we really got quite a roster of outstanding analysts speaking from different theoretical perspectives, and that was very important. A number of these people I knew, so I could kind of impress upon them, you know, would you participate? And then I had some of them introduce me to other people that I did not know. I don't never knew Edgar Levinson, but he was gracious enough to sign on. I don't know Dominique Scarfone. I think you don't you know him, Lynn?
Yes, I had consulted with him for a period of time after I moved from Michigan to L.A. And so I knew his work and knew him. And so it was great to be able to have him participate.
I think of all the people we approached, maybe only one or two said no, and strictly because it's like, look, I'm overwhelmed. I can't possibly do anything more. But people generally were excited about the project and were very willing to participate, rolled up their sleeves, worked hard, and were very appreciative of that. And I think this, in that way, is a very unique book. The format's unique, and I think it's unique to have so many different analytic voices all between two covers.
And were there any surprises and with working with some, I don't know, 14 or 15 different commentators from any
25.
Oh, wow.
Were
any of them more, I don't know, harsh or like, this is the way it has to be, or, you know, there's only one way to see this, or any surprises there? Or?
Lynn, do you want to comment about that?
Yes. There were certainly a couple people who, as you read the book, you see they begin right away with this idea of this is what I would do. This is the way to go. But I was surprised by how many of our commentators were very appreciative that they weren't in the room, as Rich was talking about earlier in terms of the flawed design. They were all incredibly easy to work with, given how busy they are. Each one of them was incredibly kind and responded quickly. Both Rich and I ended up working with all of them in different capacities. There was at one point a number of the commentators needed to shorten their comments because we had very strict limits. And I was a little anxious asking them to, you know, please reduce your comments by, 1,200 words or something. But they were all very cooperative and really seemed to enjoy the task. They were excited about the book.
I want to ask you each in a minute what was your favorite chapter, and I know you each have your kind of own chapter where you presented one of your clinical moments. So, and you have license to make that your favorite chapter. But one of mine was actually, Lynn, was your chapter, because I think the commentators were Rachel, I don't know if it's pronounced Blass or Blass, and then was it Rosemary Balsam? And they were very different, coming from very different perspectives. And of course, Rachel, whenever I read her, she argues very strongly for very defined kind of limits about what is psychoanalysis and what it's not. And I always appreciate how sort of firmly she argues about the truth of psychoanalysis, because it really sort of is challenging to one's own thinking. So that was one of my favorite sort of chapters in the book. And but there were several where I just learned so much. But why don't each of you sort of say, tell us about one of your chapters and anything surprising that happened or why you liked it.
For a host of reasons, I like Michelle Gomes' chapter, Considering Third Party. She tells the story of this patient who brings a kitten into the consulting room and drops it into Michelle's hands and puts her in a terrible bind because he's someone who tortured animals when he was younger. Whether Michelle, as his therapist, ought to give the kitten back and trust the kitten to him, or hold the kitten and take care of it herself. It was a very unusual situation. You know, where does her allegiances lie? It raised all kinds of questions about third parties. You know, like if you have a patient who's abusing a child, you know, do you feel aligned with the child? Or, you know, when husband and wife are in conflict and you're treating the wife and you're not quite sure she's being fair to the husband, and you suddenly feel drawn into an allegiance with someone outside the room. Very interesting question. And I particularly like the commentary by Edgar Levinson. I think, you know, he pinpoints something about what therapists can and can't expect themselves to be and to do. And I particularly like how he, you know, says, look, you know, if you think you're going to be a better parent than the patient's parent, think again. You know, it's very interesting where he goes, especially for a relationist. I really liked what he says in this chapter. I think it's a good teaching section. So that's why I like Michelle's. But there are so many interesting conundrums. In one chapter written by Jim Perkins, basically he's interpreting down a particular path, and the patient says to him, if you keep this up, if you keep, you know, hammering at this, I'm going to walk out. And Jim does actually continue along the path, but, you know, it was a little harrowing that he would elect to do that. So I think that's an interesting conundrum. There are a couple of chapters about countertransference enactments, one presented by Jill Modell-Barth and the other by Susan Orbach, that really look at the question of how the therapist gets stirred up and what you do with that. I like that. And one by Janet Smith, where the patient is really wanting concrete answers, and Janet's trying very hard to, you know, not give concrete answers and to get the patient to look at her need for concrete answers. So all of those are interesting. And I have the last chapter is one in which I had a patient who had kind of worried me sick when he momentarily disappeared. I couldn't find him. He wasn't showing up to sessions. And he had earlier on said, you know, there could come a time when I'm just not going to show up and I'm not going to answer your call. And it really got me quite upset. And amazingly, this seemed to have been a trigger, one of the triggers that landed me in the hospital with appendicitis. So the idea that a therapist's worry about a patient could actually get the therapist that sick is a very interesting kind of dilemma. So those are my thoughts about the various chapters. Lynn, do you have a particularly favorite one?
You know, it's funny because like you, it's very hard to choose. There were three that stand out in my mind. But each of them, in one way or another, as you were saying, Rich, with Michelle Gomes, that there are these just gems of teaching thoughts that are just right there. I loved Michelle's chapter with the kitten, in part because in reading it, as a reader, I felt there in the room, that it, the description of the clinical moment was so viscerally there. And the commentators had such different ideas about how to proceed. In a similar way, I really liked Bernadette Kovacs's of the little boy, Adam, where he's a very traumatized little boy who really wasn't speaking and required her to be silent. And as they worked out his psychic trauma from medical procedures that he had to undergo from very, very early on in his life, that she too had a way of drawing you in to that therapy, to that moment where even though you weren't there, even though I wasn't there, I really felt as though I was there. And she was asked to put a paper bag over her head where her vision was compromised, and to be wrapped up tightly in a blanket, really recreating his experience of having to wear a helmet, of having surgical procedures where he was bound so that they could do what they needed to do, and having to think in that moment of, do I put this bag on my head? Do I really potentially endanger myself and him and the treatment, or am I trusting? And so it was in some ways very similar to that core conflict in the room. And both commentators had very different ideas about what the moment was about and how their theory led them to say, Sugarman said no, that he would look at it completely as a conflict perspective, and you know that in some ways that wouldn't be the choice that I would be in and I would be interpreting. And Susan Donner, who really I think listens and plays and works in a similar way to Bernadette, and said that, you know, yes, that she's hearing the issue in the same way. So I liked both of those moments because they were so clear, they were so immediate, and you had to respond, and the commentators had very different ideas.
Yeah, some of these episodes were real. I'm calling them episodes, I guess, because I'm thinking they could be like TV episodes. In fact, somebody should create a Netflix series out of this book and you could like televise all these, like, because some of them are just so, like the one you just mentioned with the little boy that asked the analyst to put a bag over her head, and given who that little boy was, it was not sure you'd want to do that. Or the one with the kitten with Michelle Gomes. was another real cliffhanger and kind of surprising too, as I read through that one and read how the commentators were thinking about what they would do or what was going on. It seemed like, yeah, this is right. I completely agree with this. But then at the end, Michelle described what she did in fact do. So you don't get that until the end. Well, so what happened? And it was I was surprised. Oh my gosh. I won't, spoiler alert, but so I won't say, but.
You bring to mind something that's important to emphasize, Philip, in terms of the way the chapters are organized. Each chapter begins with a little abstract, kind of telling you what's going to happen in the chapter. And then there's a brief essay that it's a bit of a literature review and a reflection on the larger issues that contextualize the moment. Then the moment gets presented, and the way in which the Clinical Moments project and program work is the presenter presents to a point and then stops. And then the group, if it's happening in a home or the commentator on the page, enters in and says, well, this is what I think and this is what I do. And only at the end then does the presenter say, okay, now this is how I handled it and this is how it unfolded. So that's the schema of each chapter and of the program. So as Lynn's mentioning, you eventually do hear what ultimately happens, but the way the design was is that the commentators did not know what the presenter finally ended up doing and how it worked out. So they were blind to that. Now that's a little bit of the experimental design that makes it a little scientific. It's like, okay, you guys, and I worked very hard to make sure none of the commentators knew, the ultimate outcome of the moment. And so they're kind of blind to that. So that's a good thing scientifically.
I'm glad you brought that up because, we're so involved in Clinical Moments that I forget that was an important part that isn't mentioned. I've heard from one or two commentators since the book has come out, and so they didn't know up until they received the book, one, what the other commentator wrote or what the analyst chose to do in the situation. And so I spoke with Rosemary Balsam, and she commented that it was so interesting for her to, one, hear what actually happened, and also to be able to read what the other commentators had said. And so I think in some ways it's interesting for the commentators who now have the book and who are reading it to be able to see what their fellow commenters have said and to hear what actually happened.
Yeah, it makes me think that I think this book is really helpful in promoting kind of a generous spirit of people from different perspectives talking to each other very respectfully. And also, really honestly, I think, and genuinely sharing sort of vulnerable moments that happen sometimes. Richard, what you talked about, the patient who actually made you literally sick and you ended up in the hospital. I think probably lots of us have had experiences where something happens, especially when it comes around a patient who disappears for suddenly, unexpectedly a period of time, and you begin wondering, oh my gosh, did they finally do it? Or I've had that happen and it can ruin an entire weekend. Or another analyst, I forget which one, she really talked about how a patient came at her really strongly, and she was sort of almost knocked off her perch and said, I've always had trouble in responding in moments of extreme sort of aggression from others and holding my own and something like that. And I felt very sympathetic to her in that. And I thought it was really courageous to sort of share some of those moments when we're really vulnerable and not always on top of our game.
Yeah, that was Rena Friedman's chapter. I like that too. The admission, the humble admission of a kind of a vulnerability. We all are vulnerable for our own personal reasons to certain kinds of clinical moments. And she was very forthcoming that this was one issue she was sensitive to, but handled it heroically, I think, quite well, even though, you know, she had this vulnerability.
So we're kind of winding down here, but are there, I think you said somewhere in the introduction that there might be another book like this coming along, or what are your thoughts about other projects similar to this or not?
Well, I, you know, when we were doing this, I was so jazzed by the whole idea, although it was a tremendous amount of work. And I should mention that a number of the people contributing the clinical moments had not written before, and everybody who commented had written. And so we were working with a group of psychoanalysts, some of whom, you know, I unfortunately had to give a lot of notes to in terms of getting them to modify their clinical moments to get them up to speed. But they finally did. And I feel so good about the fact that we've brought along a whole group of people who've never written, who now have written. And I feel good about that. But as we were doing it, I thought, geez, you know, there's probably all kinds of clinical moments out there in the world. And so Lynn and I put into the book, look, this could be the first of many such volumes. In fact, I wanted to call it Volume 1, but the publisher wasn't keen on that. Whether this is grandiose and you know, very expectant, or whether we actually might get people from every which way to send us clinical moments that are as rich as these and might go at it again with another 12. That would be my hope. We now have a format. We have a whole roster of commentators. It would be great because I think that the format is very, very accessible and educational. So that would be my hope, whether that ever comes to pass. We'll see. So Lynn, did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think it would be fascinating. It's very labor intensive. I actually am, this is the first time I've been published. But the process of kind of getting so many people to respond in a short period of time took a lot of time, but I know a number of people who are already beginning to use the book in classes that they teach.
Yeah, I was thinking I could teach a class with this book. It'd be a really easy way to put together a curriculum and really an interesting way to learn. Well, so thank you both for this very, really terrific book.
You're welcome. It was our pleasure.
You're welcome.
So you've been listening to an interview with Drs. Lynn Kutnauer and Richard Tusch about their book, Conundrums and Predicaments in Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis, here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis podcast. Check out our website and feel free to email me with your comments and questions. Thanks for listening.